Your main character is a 14-year-old girl named Anastasia Zoe, AZ for short. How is it that she winds up swimming laps in her clothes at the Seahorse Inn?
She ends up swimming laps in her clothes because she is obsessed with swimming, because she is obsessed with all things to do with the Sea of Santiago, which is the miraculous inland sea that has appeared in her small hometown in the Ozark Mountains of Arkansas 20 years before her birth. And so she's wanting to prepare all the necessary skills, whether it's sailing or collecting data as an oceanographer or swimming laps, to be able to go out into the sea and successfully find out what the true nature of the sea is, which no one has been able to study because the sea is controlled by a conservative religious group that only allows people as far as the little swimming lagoon at Mud Beach.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast all about authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Alexandra Teague about the principles behind Flotation, her debut novel, a coming-of-age story set to the backdrop of a Southern miracle. This show was recorded in Spokane, Washington, during their annual Get Lit Literary Festival and with the support of Spokane Public Radio. Let's just go to the miracle.
Absolutely. So AZ and her friend Larsley are at the Miracle Museum, which is on the grounds of the Miracle Play, which is where a nightly reenactment of the miracle that formed the sea occurs during the pilgrim season, which is as soon as it gets unicy enough, so mid-spring on through the fall. And they are killing some time before the play starts, and they have gone to the Miracle Museum. The museum is dim and has mildewy-smelling blue carpet, and it shouldn't be cool, but sort of is. The walls are painted with the story of the miracle, beginning with Nell Gording's near-death sickness in the spring of 1955, her instantaneous recovery when she found a rowboat floating on her family's cow pond, and finally, the miraculous appearance of the sea, which began with rain rippling the pond in March 1955. Within a month, it covered the Gordings' pastures all the way to the Missouri border. In front of the murals is a replica of the wooden rowboat, studded with shells and tiny white barnacles from drifting across millennia and oceans. In some way that only Nell can fully understand, the boat belonged to the Apostle James, whose bones once showed up in a similar boat in a cow pasture in Santiago de Compostela, Spain. Of course, since that was a Catholic miracle, the Spanish people only got a boat with bones. For the Newark Church, the boat was just the first sign. The real wonder was when God sent an entire inland saltwater sea. Actually, as AZ has read, this part of the Ozarks was, millennia ago, covered by an even bigger inland sea. The earliest maps of North America show a vast sea stretching across this whole area, and the limestone still holds fossils of trilobites and segmented mollusks. Scientifically, it sort of makes sense that a sea would return.
And AZ has a particular attachment to the sea because 20 years after its arrival, she's born.
Yes. And her mother's water actually breaks on the beach, and so she believes that that's a sign, because she's always felt a connection to the sea since she was very little, that there was this sign that she's supposed to be its first oceanographer.
Right. Yes. Will you read that scene? Because it's so great.
The first time she saw the sea, she wasn't even born yet. It was March 19th, 1975, the 20th anniversary of the miracle, and of course her dad was covering the celebration. Even her mom came because she was 2 weeks overdue and might need to be rushed to the hospital. March tends to be rainy, but the sky had cleared, and Nell Gording, in an Easter dress and pearls, was making a speech on Mud Beach. Above, bright streamers of green and gold and red fireworks fizzled into the sea, and maybe it was the explosions which were startling the gulls and making them dive toward the water, or maybe, as AZ likes to think, the time for her birthday had just arrived, but right then, AZ's mom's water broke, right there on the beach. AZ shouldn't be able to remember this, but she swears she does. The distant low booms and the shriek of gulls, like she's hearing it from inside a shell, her synchronous birth, her destiny to be the Sea of Santiago's first oceanographer and learn everything about how it really came to be. The story that no one, not even her mother or her father, knows.
That seems like such a teenage thing to say and think.
Oh, absolutely. And it's so key to her character because her father is the town's one journalist, and he does all of the editing and reporting on everything that happens in the county. And her mother is the county librarian or the city librarian and kind of controls all the books in town and also seems to always know everything that AZ is doing and also tells all these long, strange stories of her life. So for AZ to be able to get a story that her parents don't know, it seems sort of impossible in this context.
So like any good novel where a teenager is the protagonist, the adults are kind of buffoons.
Yes, from AZ's perspective, certainly.
And her father, who you just mentioned.
He's the editor and reporter. One journalist.
As the town's only journalist.
Yes.
He speaks in alliteration.
Yes.
How on earth did that come to mind to be part of his character?
I was just talking to my own father about this yesterday and trying to remember when I first came up with that. My father was a journalist when I was young. He's not really anything like the character of James, but I did grow up around journalism. And journalists do use alliteration a lot to be catchy in headlines, but not to the extent that James does. And I think that actually, like with many things in the book, that I just wrote a line about James liking alliteration and then thought that it would be a funny joke to continue through the book and ran with it. And I think it just came about, honestly, through something early that he says that's alliterative. And then I was like, well, what would it be like if he always does that? Because James is such a kind of frantic, I mean, lovingly sort of frantic character who's just always behind on his deadlines. Yes. And that, of course, mounts as the story goes on. And I think of alliteration as being one of the ways that he can kind of attempt to keep a tiny bit of control.
Yeah, absolutely. He has so many pens in his pockets.
Yes,
always.
Yes. Often leaking ink down onto his shirts. Yeah.
And one of the examples of his alliteration, AZ and her father are eating lunch at the Chinese restaurant. And it's enormous, elegant, energizing egg rolls.
Yes.
And in contrast, how would you describe AZ's mother?
AZ's mother is much calmer than her father, and she's also the force of more control in the family. She's the one who is more likely to punish AZ. I mean, when AZ gets grounded at the start, she says, your father is furious at you, but AZ thinks her father doesn't look remotely furious. He's just busy typing, as he always is, right? And the mother is also very caught up in her own strange, tragic background and story, which simultaneously sort of distances her from what's happening in the present. But in another way, that's the lens that she uses to understand what's happening with AZ and with Kristoff. And it makes her in some ways more compassionate to things that you wouldn't think that the mother would necessarily be understanding of with her daughter.
Yes, absolutely. I want to come back to Sophie, her mother, in a moment, but you mentioned Kristoff.
Yes.
So let's just dive in. Okay. This whole story takes place largely over the course of a summer.
Yes.
And AZ has an agenda for this summer.
Yes.
And what's her agenda?
She is going to complete an independent study that she has just come up with. She's got a biology teacher named Mrs. Reuter, and she's asked Mrs. Reuter if she can borrow her refractometer, which is used to study saline levels and the PPT, the parts per thousand of saline in the water. And AZ has this idea that she's going to understand something through the saline levels that she collects over the summer about the nature of the sea, whether there are inlets or outlets that are making the water more or less salty in comparisons to other seas and oceans in the world. And so she wants to get that data for this independent study and to be able to send the data with her application for Sea Camp, which is an oceanography program that she's applying to go to in the Florida Keys over winter break the next year. But she's just come up with all of this because apparently most people who go to Sea Camp have oceanography programs at their schools, and there's nothing like that. And so she's invented this independent study.
Amazing. And there are some distractions.
There are some distractions, yes.
Namely, this young man who enters her world.
Yes. And initially, she doesn't think he'll be a distraction because he seems like he is also interested in, well, he doesn't directly say, he just says it's cool that she's thinking about building a research raft to be able to go out and get the data. And so she has a tendency to read on to everything he says that he's very enthusiastic about her project as well. And so she thinks about him as her, you know, research partner. And he has some sort of, I wouldn't even call them agendas. He's just very caught up in his vision of himself as a radical nihilist conceptual artist.
That's right. And tell us about his art initially.
His art initially is that he is rearranging the motel signs. So since this is a big tourist or pilgrim area, there are signs for all of the motels and businesses. And he's rearranging the letters on those signs where the letters come out to say all kinds of things. Like, she initially doesn't know that this is his sign, but the hotel where she's swimming laps, as you mentioned, has a sign that's supposed to say big discount because there's construction happening next door and they're offering a discount. But instead, the sign says big disco. And so he's doing that sort of thing to the signs. Yeah.
And so she thinks that because he has this sort of creative bone in his body, that she can wrap him into maybe helping her build this raft.
Yes.
And that he has, I don't know, some sort of talents in that.
Yeah. Well, he also has construction skills because she also sees him working construction at that construction site next door. So, yeah, she gets the double thing. He has construction skills and seems to want to do this radical plan with her. Yeah.
Tell me how it is that you manage to bring together a young man. He's, how old is he in comparison to
her? A year and a half older, so see, he's 16.
And so he's 16. He's really into conceptual art, but he also is managing the trash fires outside of his mother's trailer.
Yes.
How did you bring those two elements together?
I actually saw those two elements together a lot growing up in the Ozark Mountains of Arkansas, and I was really interested in writing a character who it was hard to tell whether his strange art and behavior is a result of him being very artsy or a result of his really bad home situation in which he's basically living on Mountain Dew and often doesn't have enough food. I mean, he's about 6 feet tall. He's this growing boy and his mom is always spending her paycheck on other things and not buying groceries. And so, and their power is often shut off. So he's got this very destabilized home life, and I think there are a lot of indications that the things that he's making are in response to that as much as they are to these sort of high concepts, but he conceptualizes it as being because of theories of art that Mark Rothko had or that the artist Christo had and so on. And so I think that that intersection is very real in many small towns in America and with teenagers, and kind of, and also being able to tell whether somebody's having some instability or even mental health issues or whether they're just artsy or whether they're just teenager or whether they're just hormonal and so on. So I really wanted to write that kind of male character.
It's a really interesting trifecta to have, I think, in a male character. And AZ's mother takes a shine to him in a way.
She does, because he's interested in art. He comes to the library and wants to look at the art books. He listens to her stories, and he takes to her as well. I mean, AZ's always saying, well, my mom's really controlling. And he says, yeah, but your mom knows a lot about art. Like, he likes that she engages him, and again, because he doesn't get much positive attention at all from his mother. So they actually have a pretty good relationship, which I think AZ is sometimes kind of, it's helpful to her, but she also gets kind of frustrated about it and at times says, you're siding with Kristoff over me.
It stands in contrast, her relationship with her mother. Will you take us to the scene where after they've been spending some time together, they go out to the sea at night?
Absolutely. So they're actually out on a boat that they found at this point, which AZ, they found it in a junk pile by the sea where they've been trespassing. And AZ wants to repair the boat in all these elaborate ways that she's learned about through reading about boat building and repair. And Kristoff wants to put duct tape on it to seal the holes, because he says duct tape fixes everything.
And
he's carrying around duct tape. And I'm pretty sure that multiple people when I was that age told me that. Yeah, that's just... So they're out in the boat. I can't swim, Kristoff says. She laughs, which makes her feel better for a second. Yeah, right. No, really. What? She feels sort of bad for laughing, but she's also worried. They're not too far from shore, but the boat is taking on water fast. She has to stay calm, be the captain. I'd better climb out and push while you row. She jumps overboard a little more gracefully than she got in, side-stroking awkwardly with her right arm while she holds on with her left. For a second, it works. But when Kristoff starts rowing, the bow swings back around and she loses hold, reaching towards something that is maybe the boat and maybe air, and then the bow swings back again, slamming her. "Maybe you need to get out too," she calls, "and help me pull." With neither of their weights, the boat rides higher, the sea rising to nearly her shoulders. Kristoff is tall enough that his chest is out of the water, and he can shove towards shore with the next wave. With him standing and pushing and her swimming and pulling, they gain some ground, and eventually the bow scrapes against a root. She lies in the silty water beside it, shaking but euphoric. "I didn't think it would float," Kristoff says. This kind of doesn't make sense, because he means he thought the boat would sink, but he got in anyway. But it kind of does make sense, because AZ thought it might sink, and she got in too. "I know," she says. "You know, boats have to sink a little in order to float. That's one of the principles behind flotation. And even though this is a really geeky thing to say, and even though it doesn't really apply to boats with holes in them, it seems sort of profound right now." And Kristoff must think so, too, because he smiles and leans away from her. So, if they could see anything, they could really see each other. "You know, you're not limited like other people," he says.
You've been listening to Alexandra Teague read from The Principles Behind Flotation. This is The Right Question. I'm Sarah Aronson. This conversation is available online at mtpr.org. Also, check out our podcast and visit our Facebook page.
I love that metaphor of boats need to sink a little in order to float.
Thank you.
And it's also the title of the book. So how did that come to you?
Well, it was not the title of the book for the first 9 years that the book was in progress in various stages. The book was called The Most Glorious Birds, which comes from the Harold and Maude epigraph. And that had always seemed the right title to me. And my wonderful editor, Chelsea Emil Hines at Skyhorse, after she bought the book, was talking to Skyhorse's marketing people and other editors there. And they really felt as though the title didn't represent the spirit of the book. And she wanted me to come up with something else. And I kept resisting and trying to just change a word here and there. Basically, was hoping that they would cave and let me keep my title. And finally, it became clear that they were not going to do that, and they were offering all these other titles that I really didn't like. So I did what she had asked, which was go back to the book and think through lines, and that came to me. I wasn't actually even physically looking at the book. I was just thinking through parts that resonated, and that came to me as a possibility. And then actually in my next round of revisions, I worked with that metaphor more. And so some of the moments like the Cartesian diver experiment right at the end of the book got added in later to play up that metaphor. And I think she was exactly right. And that moment is so romantic and tender and everything between Kristoff and AZ. And it's also so emblematic of the fact that they're both making some choices that might not. Like they simultaneously seem to completely understand each other, and they're going at this very differently. And things may not quite work out. So I ended up being really happy with it. There was also a lot of conversation about whether it was going to be stay with the principles behind flotation, because that language had been in there since quite an early draft. This scene was one I hadn't revised much. And I got some feedback that it should be the principles of flotation. And I stuck with behind because that was AZ's voice to me when she originally said it. And I also like the idea of things that are behind what we see about the world in this book.
And this last line that Kristoff says,
"Yes,
you know, you're not limited like other people."
Yes.
This book is rife with the theme of limitations, you know, whether it's Kristoff's world and maybe the socioeconomic limitations that he comes from, the limitations of Mud Beach as the only access to the sea. Where else do you see limitations come in through the characters or through the story?
Well, certainly the key one is AZ's inability to get out onto the sea because of how it's been controlled. But there are limitations but it's being controlled by the church group, partially because they can make more money if people go to the Miracle Play and to Mud Beach, but partially because they're trying to control their one view of it as this the miraculous waters that God has created. And so I see this book as very much being about it. And that's why it was called The Most Glorious Birds for so long, because that has to do with this idea of perception. And in Harold and Maude, Maude saying that she now knows that the seagulls are only seagulls, but to her, they'll always be the most glorious birds. So to the church group, these are these miraculous waters. To AZ, they are this the source of her being able to be an oceanographer and understand their true scientific nature. To Kristoff, everything is an art project. To her mother, everything has something to do with her own tragic story and her father dying in World War II and her first love dying. And to AZ's father, everything is a story that needs to be written. So it's so much about the sort of limitations of people's worldviews or perceptions of situations.
Right, which also feels related to obsession.
Yes.
Right? What's the relationship between obsession and limitation then?
Oh, that's a fantastic question. I think people's obsessions are certainly coming out of their inability to see beyond the edges of a particular worldview. I mean, with AZ, she's so smart and precocious,
yes,
right? And then she is so blind to so many things that Kristoff is telling her, actually, in his strange Kristoff way, quite directly.
Throughout,
right?
Yeah.
There are all these sorts of warnings, and she reads her own obsession with the sea and her own obsession with how things are going to work out and her own love for him and everything onto situations. And so I think that the sort of limitations of being, and I mean, this is true for all of us, that if we get very caught up in one particular view and then very obsessed with whatever is within that, it's hard to see that other people might be giving us contradictory information.
Other,
yes.
Booklist refers to this, or you as a feminist penman to watch.
Yes.
What is it like to be given the F word?
Oh, I was so thrilled with that review. And I was really a little bit surprised, actually, because my second book of poetry, The Wise and Foolish Builders, I think of as a very feminist reclaiming of a lot of history of westward expansion and historical stories, particularly centered on the story of Sarah Winchester, the heiress to the rifle fortune. And so I thought of that as a very feminist book. The book of poetry that I'm working on right now, I think of as a very overtly feminist book dealing with issues of representations of women and women's bodies in visual art and otherwise. And it's funny because, I mean, that's so core to who I am as a person. But I wasn't as overtly thinking about it in this story because this is just the way that I conceptualized AZ's character and conceptualized a lot of, I mean, there are so many strong teenage girls who are interested in science and are interested in all of these things. So it wasn't an overt choice. Like, I am going to write
right.
a feminist 14-year, a take on this 14-year-old girl. That's just who I am. And then I was so thrilled when I was like, oh, yes, that is true. And I mean, the mother is the very strong character. AZ is mm-hmm. a very strong character, I think, mm-hmm. so.
Will you read us one of your poems?
I would love to. Ophelia has not seen even one of the seven wonders of the world, and people keep making new lists. Now the largest pole on record gives her this: Christ the Redeemer, the Tower, the Martyr, the untouchable jetliner wings of his grace. Standing underneath, could a girl even see his face struck twice by lightning? Or would she still be left imagining how he blesses the sky, its sins of diffusion and cumulus, her eyes pulled up and up like a flag raising off-key bugle dawns at summer camp, grass stickering her ankles? It mattered, for some reason, just to stand there, to feel responsible for mourning, which would happen anyway, which is maybe all wonder is, the Taj Mahal's white minarets holding up grief as perfect symmetry, as every single person born will die, a chain so much longer than the Great Wall. All that rammed earth and hope and erosion and the story for centuries, you could see it from the moon, as if most people, as if a strand of human hair a mile away. It makes her wonder if we just want something huge enough to outlast our not knowing if it really outlasts us. Those pyramids, Chichen Itza, Giza in a country of car bombs, so much sand colored like stone, like sun, it must be like standing behind your own eyelids on a bright day. Phosphenes of ancient wonder, not real light, something firing in your mind. All the gods buried in cat suits of lapis and gold, and the tourists lining up like bottles at a carnival, throw the ring of I have been the size of greatness around the neck. The game isn't rigged, just impossible. A single perfect toss will win a big plush squid, a tiger dangling like a striped stalactite, mammoth cave, the London sewers, Hoover Dam, a snow cone melting like the polar ice, still the top of seven wonders to visit before they're gone, on your hands. Christ can't even save his own, one finger broken off in a second storm. She wants to say they don't make gods like they used to, but that's probably not true either. You don't get to travel back in time to wonder, but she'd like to. Once, in ancient Rome, the aurora borealis flared so bright, firemen rushed out and tried to extinguish the sky.
Whew. When I read that, I thought, this is a companion poem to the book. Do you see any relationship between the two?
I had not thought about the relationship between the two, but I wrote, Ophelia has not seen even one of the seven wonders, probably 3 years ago, while I was still very much in the midst of, I mean, the book was a 10-year process. So everything in the past 10 years has in some way been
connected.
In conversation with that. But certainly the idea of what wonder is, what people see as miraculous or wondrous in the world, what access we have to that, how we understand it, how we keep up with other people's perception of it. I mean, I love the idea in this that I didn't know until, it's very rare for me to come up with a title for a poem before I've written the poem. And in this case, I actually had the title for a year or so because I had run into online, I'm always finding strange things and researching one thing online and I'll go down these other rabbit holes, but I had run into all of these different competing lists of the seven wonders of the world. And I thought it was such a fascinating idea that I thought there was just one. I thought there were the ancient and then the more modern seven wonders. And it turns out that there's all kinds of lists of that. And so just that idea that people are coming up with all of their different versions of what is wondrous.
What's your relationship to the miraculous?
Oh, I don't believe in a religious miracle sort of sense of miracles per se, but I believe that the world greatly exceeds our understanding. And I'm going to misquote it, despite the fact that I pretty frequently quote some version of it. But in Hamlet, the line, there are more things on heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy. I think that there's a lot that we don't know about the universe. I mean, studies of the human brain right now are just barely beginning to understand how the brain even works.
Do you think teenagers are more or less predisposed to believing in miracles?
I think more disposed, because I think that when we're young, often because of lack of context, we have the sense that the world is limitless in various ways. And I think even when the world seems, or often when the world seems most overtly limited, that it's natural for the human mind, and particularly the childlike or teenage mind that's still sort of seeking to look beyond those limits and to try to find something else. I mean, this is a classic thing that there's so many teenagers who I've encountered and friends who have encountered who are teaching in high school and everything who are in the worst economic circumstances who are still absolutely convinced that they're going to be president, they're going to be the famous basketball player, they're going to be the famous artist, whatever. So I think that there is that desire to push past those limits and to see that that some kind of miracle could happen for them.
Alexandra Teague lives in Moscow, Idaho. Look for more information about her and her book and subscribe to our podcast at mtpr.org. Also, check out our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin's studio engineer. You'll find links to our podcast and Facebook page at mtpr.org.